Right.
Damn. Bunch of niggas in here now. I like it like this. All the minorities. The white folks, it's okay that you came too. The brave white people came. Because you know, white folks are sensitive. They're like little white rabbits. They'll get the fuck out of a place. You know that. It's cold, it's cold, it's cold. Then you got them ballsy white people. This nigger doesn't intimidate me. I'll stay till the sun rises. We'll see if this is a nigger vampire. Look at this white woman. Don't stare at me like that. This white lady, look how you're looking at me. I have jungle eyes. I don't miss shit. You are staring at me like I've landed from the planet Nigger Taurus. You should see your face. It's funny, but I like it. I like it. It's great. You're very pretty, and it's very nice. It's very pleasant. And he go kick your ass. Looking at that nigger. Maybe you a nigger. I don't want anybody white to be offended by me. Don't be offended. My parents are white. Please relax. And I have to keep you here long enough for my nigger friends to steal your car, so we'll be here for a minute. They said, you do the jokes, we'll get the rides. Now it's another white man. You guys, you know what I'm going to tell you? You guys tickle me. I'm going to explain something to you. See, I watch a white audience. I study them. And black performers, white people, they talk about Chinese, they talk about Mexicans, they talk about Indians, they talk about everybody. And you guys, your language, your thing, you're into it. Because I study. You're just laughing like you stare. And you just laugh. You have no sense of humor on you. You just, your whole body, you're into it. But the minute you talk about white folks, that bullshit just... Make that nigger. Stop saying nigger. I'm getting a nigger headache. I can't. Make the nigger stop saying nigger. White folks made up nigger and don't want me to say it. Ain't that a bitch? You made it up. You shouldn't have made it up. You fucked up. You shouldn't have made up nigger. And you made up a song to go with it. Please don't make me sing the song. Eeny, meeny, miny. You know the goddamn song I'm talking about. And you change the words when you see black folks. Catch a tiger. Have they gone? Hey, so you fucked up. I say nigga all the time. I say nigga 100 times every morning. It makes my teeth white. Nigga, 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 nigga. I say it, you think it, what a small white world. But you don't have any problem saying Arnold Schwarzenegger. I may not know about the space program, but I know nigger when I hear it. You guys love saying his name. Schwarzenegger. Oh, Arnold nigger. Oh, Mr. Nigger. Schwarzenegger. I didn't say it. I was hoping he'd marry Shirley Temple Black and she'd be Mrs. Shirley Temple Black nigger, but it didn't work out that way. Arnold Schwarzenegger. He's the only white man to make a movie that scared the fuck out of me. Terminator, that shit scared me. I had nightmares for 6 months. A white man that wouldn't die, that fucked me up. I threw my knife at the screen. Stab that motherfucker, stab him! He just kept coming, didn't he? Because white people are very sensitive, you have to remember that. Oh, they kill me with their sensitivity. So sensitive. It'll be some won't make this. Oh, they'll get out of here. Look like little white bunny rabbits. They'll hop out of this motherfucker. This is the lady leaving now. Look at her. She's leaving now. Yeah. I hope when you get home, niggas are burglarizing your house. Good night, ma'am. They can't take it. I'm telling you, I know white folks. They can't take. She got the fuck out of here, didn't she? They can't take it. Because all of their lives, they've been told they're the shit. White people always told you you're the best, you're everything, you're wonderful, you come from heaven, you're everything. You've never done nothing to nobody. You wear the white hat, you're the good fucking guy. And the minute they hear a nigga talk about it, freaks them. Because I study white boys. You can laugh at anybody, because white folks will talk about a nigga, you'll laugh. And the minute it's about you, white, you get that fucking bag. That no sense of humor about yourself. Fuck you. You can be talked about, too. This is America. Fuck you. Fuck.
So there you go. That's comedian Paul Mooney, the nigger. And he likes to rub it in. I talked to Paul Mooney on the telephone one time. We were even talking about doing a show, yeah, on television. And it never went through. The Jews stopped it. But I think it would have been a hell of a show. He's right about candy-ass whites. Chicken whites, chicken shit whites. Afraid of their shadow. Afraid to laugh at themselves. Don't bother me. I think we need to be laughed at once in a while. Not so much white separatists, but all the rest of these asshole whites. And I mean it. This is Terrible Tommy, and we're in the bunker today. It's the 19th of May, 2015. Tears Day. Yeah, right here in the bunker. P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations for the radio show. $20 donation per month. That's where you get 6 fresh shows each week. That's right. And let's see, it's a beautiful day. No, it's overcast and getting cold. Hell, I drove up to Fort Wayne about 50 miles today. And it was warm. No, well, it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, 3:30. Took the webmaster to the airport. And, however, when we got out and around, it was cold. It was down in the 60s, and now it's going on down. It's supposed to be around 38 tonight. Can you believe that? Hell, what the hell is happening? Well, I guess there is something to do with global warming. How about that? Well, one of our lone wolves sent me this, and I think it's pretty interesting. And let's see what he entitled it. Tom, I've been using Starbucks coffee shops to talk about the Jews. Maybe you can use this idea on your radio show. Or maybe even have a contest for the best free speech screw the Jew monologue. As you probably know, the Jew who owns Starbucks did a failed social engineering attempt at his worldwide coffee shops entitled, quote, Let's Talk About Race. Let's talk about race. The employees are trained to discuss race, but certainly not in the way we do. This is how I started. While buying a cup of coffee, I say, let's talk about race. The Jew who owns Starbucks makes a personal profit of over $2 billion every year by selling expensive coffee to everyone. Nobody needs $2 billion. But instead of distributing this obscene profit among his employees and actually helping every race, he is using his wealth to stir up racial hatreds. For example, and these hatreds are being focused on white people. For example, such events as Ferguson, Missouri, and other places are stirred up by the Jew media. The Negro thug gets shot by a white policeman in the act of committing a crime. Where am I at? Okay, and the Jews whip up the headlines, slanted against the white man. Well, sometimes these cops deserve it. Come on, there's two sides of this story. I'm not jumping on the side of the blacks, but there's plenty of cops around that shouldn't be in uniform. And a lot of them should be in jail. But do you ever hear about the 75,000 white people who are murdered every year by Negroes? No, you don't. You don't hear very much about it. No, you don't, because that doesn't fit into the Jews' agenda, fomenting racial hatreds and of targeting white people. Quote, white people are also being targeted by Jews for slavery. Well, why don't the white people fight back? You know, I hear all the time about niggers doing this, niggers doing that to white people, and white people are not fighting back. If you don't fight back, what can I tell you? But the facts of history are that the Jews were the monopoly slave traders in Europe and the Americas ever since Roman times. Well, they heavily invested in slave ships. They were involved, definitely, but they were not the major part of the slave ships. I mean, I'm sorry, boys. They were involved. Many of them owned several ships and all that kind of stuff. But let's face it, it was also a majority of white Christians involved in that kind of activity. And 95% of the slaves were white people from Northern Europe. Well, at one time they were. You can read about it in the Nation of Islam's book, The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews. Well, Farrakhan's exaggerated somewhat. It's an interesting read, but he does tend to exaggerate. Quote, the Jews were the slave traders, drivers, and slave ship owners, while it was white Christians who ended slavery. No, white Christians were up to their ass in slavery. Don't give me that conservative right-wing crap. We got to be honest, not only with ourselves, but with everybody else. A large percentage of the slaver people involved in slavery were white, and they were Christian, along with Jews. Over 1 million white people lost their lives during the Civil War to end slavery. Well, I think it was about 600,000. But the reason, the problem there is they should have shipped the blacks back to Africa. It was capitalism. That was the agrarian capitalism that wanted the blacks in here and made slaves out of them. And here again, it was a majority of the Zionist Christians, huh? Or Christians. Jews are the most hypocritical, lying swindlers and betrayers the world has ever known. And the Jew who owns Starbucks is a good example of the type. So when are you Starbucks employees going to demand a piece of that $2 billion that you are helping that deceiving Jew to amass? Well, number one, they're not going to do it. May sound good on paper, but it's not going to happen. If that Jew wants us to talk about race, then let's talk about the race of Jews who are purposely fomenting racial hatred so they can make more money by destroying this country, unquote. Well, I don't think this man wants to admit that white Christians were way involved in the slave trade and all this other stuff. And it's interesting to me, and I'm as critical of Jews as anybody else, that they always want to blame everything, even the weather change, on the Jews. And that's not going to get you recruit people, because they know that's not true. It's not all the Jews. So, Tom, there's many ways to kike a Jew. You do it your way, and I will do it my way. Or you can use one of my techniques and shove it in the face of the Jews. If the Jews want Americans to talk about race, then let's talk about race of devil Jews who are destroying this country and genociding the white race. Well, I'm going to tell you there's a better way, and that's exposing the actual things that are going on in Israel and the actual things Jews do that you can get out of the newspapers. Fraud, crime, race crime, all kinds of things that you can get right out of the newspaper. You don't have to dream them up, and you don't have to go back to the slave ships to do it. You can get the Jewish papers on the internet. You can read the articles that come out in Israel. There's all kinds of things that show the crimes of Jews, and actually Jews' crimes against themselves, against their own people. And you can expose the fact that there's so much poverty in Israel among old Jews. And you can expose the fact they're building the biggest prison concentration camp in the Middle East there in southern Israel to keep the niggers in it. So that's what you need to do. You need to use straight, hard facts to expose the operations of the Jews. Let's see, what else did he say here? If the Jews want Americans to talk about race, then let's talk about the race of devil Jews. Oh, I said that. You've been in politics, you know that politics are necessary to run a society, but you only talk about race without supplying the folks with political and economic tools for supporting our race. Well, that's not true. That's not true. It's obvious you don't listen to my radio show, and because you're too cheap to send in $20. It's really time to make a change in that regard. What do you know about Huey Long? Well, I know probably more than you do about Huey Long, the Louisiana senator who the Jews murdered. The Jews didn't murder him. One Jew murdered him, a dentist. I stood on the spot where Huey Long was assassinated in the Baton Rouge, Louisiana State House. I've studied him up one side and down the other. He was a sort of a half and half guy. He was half great, half of credit to his people, and half a con man and crook. That's the way with most white people and most people of all races. His political message is still true today. Even populism is a worn-out term. We need something new. No, we need people who put their money where their mouth is, put their muscle where their muscle is, and so forth. Anyhow, he's talking about banjoism, something, I don't know. So, but this is not the way to go after him. Going in there making a big deal about the Jew, because immediately what they'll say is, but what about the Holocaust? Well, it's terrible about all those Jews that died, right? You know that many of them were killed by their own people, turned over to the people who killed them by their own people. Do you know that probably they were sacrificed to guarantee the emergence of the state of Israel? You know those things? You know that they were Jew financiers, were involved in really turning on World War I, World War II? Did you know that? Anyhow, thanks for sending it to me, but there's a lot of holes in your argument and holes that can't be filled. You have to be honest and you have to be straight. And not say it's all the other guy and it's all these people or all those people, you know? Anyhow, that's my story and I'm sticking to it. Fellow, unfortunately, is using old-fashioned right-wing methods of attack. And that won't work anymore. It just won't work anymore. You got to be sharper than that. Don't forget, it was mostly the Christian religion that was enslaving people, not only ideologically, but physically in Europe a long time ago, before the black slave trade even started. You see, those in power, those white psychopaths that are in power, that I have nothing to do with, don't want anything to do with them, they use us against each other. And they use us, they point us at everybody else. Like it's all black, it's an all black problem. Yeah, blacks are a problem, yeah. Or it's all a Jew problem. But they point, you notice how they point away that the white ruling class, the rotten psychopaths like the last few presidents we've had, and the people in the Federal Reserve, including the Jews, they don't talk that much about them, do they? So how can, you're not going to win an argument unless you bring out all the facts, and the brutal facts, even when the facts condemn you a little bit, you know. I'm willing to admit through history that there's been a lot of bad things happen, and whites have been involved in a hell of a lot of it. And we can't accurately fight other people and point out their crimes if we're not prepared to accept the idea ourselves. This is what I mean. Israel kingpin Yitzhak Abergil was among dozens of suspects scooped up by police in what has been described as a major underworld Jew bust, according to new details from the case publication on Tuesday. Abergil, who is also in prison, is suspected of involvement in a failed attempt to target top mobster Zev Rosenstein Kaik over a decade ago in an attack that killed three bystanders. Gee whiz. God's chosen people. Pipples. Some 44 suspects were set to attend remand hearings at the Rishon LeZion Magistrates Court Tuesday. The heavy police presence was reported around the building. Among the allegations leveled at the detainees, who were said to include other leading crime bosses in Israel, Jews, and their associates, are cases of murder, attempted murder, drugs, money laundering, and other offenses. But they all claimed they were God's chosen people. Abergil and his brother Meyer were arrested on August 2008 in Israel following an American extradition request, you see. They're running around the United States. After they were named in an indictment that charged them with using a San Fernando Valley, California gang to distribute 1 million MDMA pills, colloquially known as ecstasy, and paying a gang member to kill a man for stealing a drug shipment. Jew Abigail was handed over to U.S. officials in January 2001. In May 2012, Abigail pleaded guilty to the charges as part of a plea bargain agreement and was sentenced to, get this, 8.5 years, while our guys are in there for 40, of which he has already served over 6 years. Oh, geez, they take it easy on these kikes, including time spent in prison prior to sentencing. His brother, Meyer, was sentenced to 42 months and has since been released. Abigail returned to Israel in January 2014 to serve the remainder of his sentence in a Jew prison. A gag order on the operation, dubbed Case 512, was partially lifted by the court on Tuesday, allowing for more information to emerge on what Police Chief Yohanan Danino has termed, quote, one of the most significant probes ever conducted against Jewish crime organizations in recent history, in recent memory. God's chosen peoples. Two state witnesses are said to have been involved in the investigation, which gained impetus in 2008 when police cracked the case of the failed 2003 assassination attempt of Rosenstein, leading to breakthroughs in 6 other murder cases and 15 attempted murders. Naughty boys. Jehovah would be upset with you, the Jew. These are the articles you need to get and cut out and carry them in your pocket. And when anybody wants to tell you how wonderful the Jews are, don't dream up things about blood libel and all that that supposedly happened hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Show what the Jews are doing today. It's in the newspapers. Rosenstein, Abigail's bitter rival at the time, was targeted in a bomb attack on a Tel Aviv street. Although Rosenstein survived the hit attempt, 3 innocent bystanders were killed, probably Palestinians, and 18 injured in the blast, which occurred at the height of the second Intifada, when Israel were targeted by repeated Palestinian suicide bombings. Well, if you don't have machine guns, sometimes you have to figure other ways. Rosenstein, like Abigail, later faced drug trafficking charges in the U.S. He was extradited by Israel in 2007, was sentenced to 12 years in prison, which he has been serving out in Israel. You see, 12 years. Most people here that are involved in drug activity get 20, 30, 40 years. Other crimes linked to Abigail, including the early attempt on Rosenstein, the disappearance of Israeli mob figure Micah Ben Hoshrush in South Africa, and the operation of a massive international drug trafficking ring. The Hebrew language Walla News site reported. In total, case 512 encompasses more than 40 individual investigations into Jew crimes committed over the past 12 years by some 50 Jew suspects. On Sunday, over 50 suspects across Israel were apprehended in their homes and brought in for interrogation, with officers seizing vehicles, properties, and bank accounts. The raid was the culmination of a multi-year investigation conducted by Israeli police anti-Jew fraud Lahav 433 unit, together with the Tel Aviv District Police. Attorney Sharon Nahari, who is presenting some of the suspects, played down the significance of the arrest because they're just good Jew boys. Quit picking on them. Telling Army Radio it wasn't the first time the police have made grandiose statements about arrests and organized crime. That's Jewish organized crime. Quote, I think we need to wait and see exactly what the evidence is and how strong it is, and then draw conclusions, this Jew said. Israel officials have vowed over recent years to step up operations against organized Jew crime amid a string of car bombings linked to the syndicates which have rocked Israeli cities. Well, there you go. There you go. Now, you don't need to use right-wing blood libel arguments and all that kind of stuff. This is reality. This was in the Jerusalem papers today. Just go get them off the internet, print them out, stick them in your pocket. When anybody tells you how wonderful the Jews are, just start peeling off these articles. That'll do more good than anything else, because they're not going to deny that. Hey, it's in the paper. Or how about this one? To say it's been a bad year for Jewland's police force would be an understatement, starting with the botched case against the suspects of the Bar Noir homosexual club shooting. Oh, chosen people are shooting up gays. How about that? And ending with massive protests against police brutality and racism. Wasn't the Jews all the time accusing everybody in the United States of being white racist? What? The pan called the pot black. With more than a smattering of scandals that besmirch the police force's brass in between, crooked cops, including a goodly number of sexual harassment allegations in the police force, it's safe to say that men in blue have been feeling pretty black and blue. That's Jew-who, you know? So it likely comes as something of a relief to them to see Tuesday's papers replete with reports of major underworld Jew crime busts. The raid, which netted dozens of gangland suspects from one crime family, including the head, according to the reports, is characterized in the Jewish Afro-Knot as an earthquake for the country's underworld crooked killer Jews, and is viewed in the press through the lens of the turbulent times the police have been through. Though many details of the case remained under gag order at the time of the paper's printing, a senior police source tells Yedoeth Aranath that the public will soon see how great the multi-year probe into the crime family was, hinting that the fuzz will thus be vindicated. Oh, they got problems with cops over there too. Once we are able to publicize all the details, the public will be proud of the Jew police. This case is supposed to be a game changer in the never-ending battle against crime organizations. The source is quoted saying, the paper includes rundown on the many unsolved car bombings that have plagued parts of Israel for years past, including the one police now say, after the papers were printed, is at the heart of the case, which was that 2003 car bombing in Tel Aviv at the Jew crime boss, Zev Rosenstein, but ended up killing three bystanders. I told you that. So there's more. I mean, I can give you tons of it. Like tons of stuff about the Jews that is real, is happening right now. You don't have to dream up this anything. But at the same time, I want you also to expose the rotten, corrupt, psychopathic elite of the white race. You know, if you're going to be believed by anybody, you got to be fair and just. How many people do you hear calling on talk shows and exposing these Jew crimes? Now, you even hear them downgrading non-Jew whites. They have no problem with that. But how many times do you hear the report on Jew crime? And I dare you call in on the radio talk show and say, tell them about some of these crimes going on in the mob over there in Israel and like that. You won't hear it on either the progressive or the conservative neocons. So, see, a lot of this started back when there was competition, of course, between the Jews and the Christian church for power. Of course, the Jews didn't have the numbers, but they had the ways of developing banking and all that through the Rothschilds and all these other people. But even though the Christian Church, Catholic Church, condemned the Jews, they liked to use the Jews, because it was against the law for Christians to loan out money and on usury and so forth. So guess what? The Christian Church used to hire the Jews to... And the kings used to hire the Jews to collect the taxes. And as long as they were good little Jews making the king lots of money and the Catholic Church a lot of money, they were okay. But they'd let it go so far because finally the peasants would get so fed up with these Jew tax collectors, they'd rise up and kill a few of them. Then guess what happened? The king would let it go on for a while to get the Jews back in line. Quit clipping the coin of the round, the coin and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, that's what he'd do. Then he'd say, all right, that's enough of that shit. He'd send the army out and beat the shit out of the peasants and save the Jews. That's the way the game was played. It's always been played that way. And of course, much of the crap it's accused the Jews of was just Christian fabrications. Christian church fabrications. Because the Christian church is just as crooked and rotten as about anything else. Probably as rotten as the Jews themselves. So you got to remember that if you're going to get any place in this struggle and be honest. And you know it's true. Hell, a lot of people out there that are in the so-called white separatist cause, they know it's true, but they don't. They spend all their time. You go down to these right-wing racial chat boards, and they go on and on and on and on. Oh, the Jews did everything. And the Jews cause everything. Or the niggers cause everything. But they don't really go after certain power people in the white race. Oh, they go after some. But I mean, they never really admit the tremendous power of the psychopathic whites who are our enemies just as much as crooked Jews or crooked or violent blacks. And if we don't approach it from that angle, you're never going to get any place because people recognize dishonesty. And that's one of the major problems when people get on TV or anything else, white racists, to debate. They go on one side, but they don't go on the other. These people are all bad, but these people are all good. You know? That's not right. That's why I use a lot of progressive stuff. A lot of the progressive stuff is fine on economy and jobs and the rotten capitalists and all that kind of stuff. I have no problem with that. If the right wing would ever be honest and quit being such warmonger bastards and say they really want to rebuild the infrastructure of the United States for white people, instead of always scaring the hell out of the white public and getting them to go to war, getting them being killed. Like recently everybody was moaning, or a lot of people were moaning, because Fallujah over there in Iraq was retaken by ISIS. Now, of course, you know that the Bush family created ISIS. There's no doubt about that. They created ISIS. But a whole lot of white troop and army and Marines got killed in Fallujah. But beyond that, there were hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who were killed in Fallujah. And also, this nuclear poisoning, spent nuclear material and all the weapons has so radiated the Fallujah area that horrible birth rates are happening over there and are going to happen for 100 years. I mean, you know, people with all kinds of weird stuff, maybe a kid with two heads. I mean, you know, that's our government. That's our psychopaths. And they're white. And we got to condemn them. That's why I would swing to a lot of times the progressives on that issue. We got to do it. We got to be honest. And, you know, it's wrong to go in and occupy a country that's not ours and bomb it into nothing but scraps of cement and all that and concentrate on killing civilians. They lie to you. They say they don't, but they do. All countries at war target civilians. They sure as hell did the Germans. Working class neighborhoods, and the Germans did it the same thing to the English, and the English did it to them, and the French did it to the Germans, and the Russians did it to the Poles. You see, these leaders, so-called leaders, are psychopaths. They're psychopaths. Let me give you a hint. We've got a lot of people out there think Putin, maybe his crap don't stink. I want to tell you something. I watch people very closely on TV. I watch their body language. Body language is very, very good. It tells you a hell of a lot about a person. The other day I watched Putin meeting up with Kerry. And I watched the body language on Putin. Putin has a problem, an inferiority complex. I could see it written all over him. And for a small man with an inferiority complex, you know what comes out of that? A lot of bad shit. So if you think you're going to trust Putin to be the great white hope, forget it. Who knows what the hell he's going to pull? Because he don't look people in the eye. He didn't look Kerry in the eye. He dodged around and swished around his eyes like that. The body language was terrible. Anybody that knows about body language knows I'm telling you the truth. Watch out for Putin. Now, there are people going to say, oh my God, we sort of thought Putin was good. And they're going to say, you're saying our leaders are bad. Of course our leaders are bad. Kerry's bad. Kerry's got fairly good body language, though, if you watch him closely. He's tall. That's one thing in his favor. Tall politicians do well. He looked people in the eye. At least it looked like that to me. So Kerry's pretty good at what he does, even though he's a rat, too. I mean, they're all rats. Now sign up for some of these Israel Jew papers and read about this stuff. It's right out there in the open for everybody to see. You don't have to dig very far, and you can get it every day or every few days. All those Israel papers, you get the radio stations that tell all the bad shit. They tell it. They tell it right on there. Yeah. Well, get the New York City papers. Jew crime all over the newspapers in New York. Dig around a little, boy. You don't have to talk about what the Catholic Church didn't like about the Jews 1,000 years ago, or 400 years ago, or 500 years ago. Just read what the Jews are actually doing criminal-wise now. It's easy. And then go to Starbucks and say, do you know that these guys are organized crime in Israel and they killed all these people and planted car bombs? And they say, oh, that didn't happen. They're too good of people. We'll pull out the article and show them. Now, here's an example I want to make for you. I'm going to play a little recording about a book. It's a book report. It's on the bestsellers list now. 700 pages on Capital. And when a right-wing conservative looks at this, and many of the leaders in the racial cause say, oh, my God, these guys are left-wingers. They're progressives. Don't listen to anything they say. Well, that's where you make the mistake. Nobody lies all the time. Nobody tells the truth all the time. So if you want to know about really what's happening, you're going to listen to people you don't like. In fact, the moderator here is a very staunch anti-racist. And I understand that. But do you think I'm not going to put out what is correct on the economy and so forth just because he is opposed to racism? Well, hell no. I'll use his weapon. I'll use his ammunition. And you should too. And that's why the conservative right-wing racial cause can't get anywhere. They say, oh, I could never use that stuff. That guy's a progressive. He's a liberal. He maybe even be a communist. The question is he telling the truth? That's the important thing. Even though you don't like him and you don't like his views on race, is he telling the truth about other things? Now, this is probably going to be, for some reason, my audio is a little low on this today, so I'm going to play it, and I hope you can understand it. If you can't, let me know, and I'll redo it.
One of its extraordinary insights, we are heading into a future dominated by inherited wealth, as capital concentrates in fewer and fewer hands, giving the very rich ever greater power over politics, government, and society. Patrimonial capitalism is the name for it, and it has potentially terrifying consequences for democracy. For those who work for a living, the level of inequality in the U.S., writes Piketty, is probably higher than in any other society at any time in the past, anywhere in the world. Over three decades, between 1977 and 2007, 60% of our national income went to the richest 1% of Americans. No wonder this is the one book the 1% doesn't want the other 99% to read. Paul Krugman has been writing extensively and generously about Piketty's book. The Nobel Prize-winning economist and New York Times columnist calls it a tour de force a magnificent, sweeping meditation on inequality that will change both the way we think about society and the way we do economics. As scholar, author of many books, and widely read columnist and blogger, Paul Krugman has himself changed a lot of thinking on politics and economics. Welcome back.
Hi.
Inequality has been on the table for a long time. You've written extensively. Others have, too. I mean, it's a familiar issue. But what explains that this book has now become a phenomenon?
Actually, a lot of what we know about inequality actually comes from him, because he's been an invisible presence behind a lot. So when you talk about the 1%, you're actually, to a large extent, reflecting his prior work. But what he's really done now is he said, even those of you who talk about the 1%, you don't really get what's going on. You're living in the past. You're living in the 80s. You think that Gordon Gekko is the future. And Gordon Gekko is a bad guy. He's a predator, but he's a self-made predator. And right now what we're really talking about is we're talking about Gordon Gekko's son or daughter. We're talking about inherited wealth playing an ever-growing role. So he's telling us that we are on the road not just to a highly unequal society, but to a society of an oligarchy, a society of inherited wealth, patrimonial capitalism. And he does it with enormous amount of documentation, and it's a revelation. I mean, even for someone like me, it's a revelation.
I was going to ask, what does Paul Krugman have to learn from this book?
Even the title, the first word in the title, capital. We stopped talking about capital. Even people like me stopped talking about capital, because we thought it was all about human capital. We thought it was all about earnings. We thought that the wealthy were people who, one way or another, found a way to make a lot of money.
Right.
And we knew that that wasn't always true. We knew that in the Gilded Age or in the Belle Epoque in Europe, which he prefers to talk about, that high incomes were mostly the result of having lots and lots of assets. But we sort of said, well, that's not the way things work anymore. And he says, oh, yeah? It turns out that you're wrong, that it's true that right now a lot of high incomes in America are people who didn't start out all that rich, but we're rapidly moving towards a state where inherited wealth dominates. I didn't know that. I should have known it. I should have thought about it, but I didn't. And so then here comes this book with, I mean, it's beautiful. It happens to be analytically beautiful, if that makes any sense at all.
Yes, as you know, I'm no economist, but I found this book, as I said in the opening, just very readable, and suddenly there'd be this moment of epiphany.
Yeah, it's a real eureka book. You suddenly say, oh, this is not, the world is not the way I saw it. The world, in fact, has moved on a long way in the last 25 years, and not in a direction you're going to like, because we are seeing not only great disparities in income and wealth, but we're seeing them get entrenched. We're seeing them become inequalities that will be transferred across the generations. We are becoming very much the kind of society we imagined we're nothing like.
Here's Piketty's main point. Capital tends to produce real returns of 4-5%, and economic growth is much slower. What's the practical result of that?
What that means is that if you have a large fortune, suppose that our family has a large fortune, they can, inheritors of that large fortune, can live very, very well. They can live extraordinary standard of living and still put a large fraction of the income from that fortune aside, and the fortune will grow faster than the economy. So the big dynastic fortunes tend to take an ever-growing share of total national wealth. So when you have a situation where the returns on capital are pretty high and the growth rate of the economy is not that high, you have a situation in which not only can people live well off inherited wealth, but they can actually pass on to the next generation even more, an even higher share. So it's all, in his terms, R, the rate of return on capital, and G, the rate of growth of the economy. And when you have a high R, low G economy, which is what we now have, then you're talking about a situation in which dynasties come increasingly to dominate the top of the economic spectrum, and a tiny fraction of the population ends up very dominant.
What's the realistic impact of this on working people?
There's a direct impact, which is that part of income is always going to go to labor, although that seems to be a diminishing fraction, but the part that comes from capital is going to be in the hands of a very few people. The other thing, which I think is critically important, he talks about more towards the end of the book, is political economy. That when you have, what Teddy Roosevelt could have told you and did, that when you have a few people who are so wealthy that they can effectively buy the political system is going to tend to serve their interests. And that is going to reinforce this shift of income and wealth towards the top.
Do you agree with him that we are drifting toward oligarchy?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I don't think that's even, I don't see that there's any question of it. If you look at the Certainly, if you look at what we know already, and we're learning more, we know already about the concentration of income, of wealth, you can see that it is growing. You can see that, and you can actually see, I spent a little while just sort of going through the Forbes 400 list. And what you find is already an awful lot of inherited wealth in there. It's no longer a list of self-made men. And of the self-made men, a lot of them are pretty elderly. And those fortunes are going to be passed on to next generation. So the drift towards oligarchy is very visible, both casual observation and in the numbers.
I was taken with something you wrote the other day. You said that, in your opinion, the real problem is not capital accumulation per se, as much as it is, quote, remarkably high compensation and income. Now, how does that differ from what you were just saying about wealth that passes to the next generation?
So right now, high incomes are still primarily coming from people who've made a lot of money, typically as corporate executives. That has been the story. So the big expansion of inequality in the United States since the 1970s has so far been driven by high salaries, high bonuses, and so on. That's where we are now. But our image of the top is really a quarter century old. It is about the way things were when these great fortunes were just getting started, when we were just seeing the explosion of inequality. But we're well along the way towards one in which it is, in fact, an older thing, where people accumulate capital, pass it on to their heirs, and you get these dynastic wealth. So right now, and this is where Piketty has interesting things to say, but not this compelling vision about why America is so unequal right now, but looking forward, he's telling us that the story is already changing, and it's going to change more. So we are going to probably, unless something gets better, we're going to look back nostalgically on the early 21st century, when you could still at least have the pretense that the wealthy actually earned their wealth. And, you know, by the year 2030, it'll all be inherited.
And at the same time, we can't even manage to pay workers a minimum wage of $10.10.
Yeah, and what's amazing, I thought actually one of the most depressing things, although enlightening in his book, is he talks about France in the Belle Epoque, years before World War I, which was ideologically as much a society committed to equality in principle as we are today, but in practice was totally dominated by very wealthy families, where it was impossible to even raise the possibility of seriously taxing great wealth. It was very hard to do anything to improve the conditions of ordinary workers. And it shows you how that can happen, how you can have a society where even though the ideology is democratic, even though we claim that all men are equal, in practice, it's not a chance.
Isn't that what's happening now in this
country? Exactly. That's the point. And what's funny is, at the time, Americans used to say, oh, we should never allow ourselves to become like old Europe, and in fact, we have.
But we have had the Rockefellers. We've had the Carnegies. We've had the Pews. We've had big dynasties that transferred their wealth from one generation to another.
Yes. Before World War I, we had our dynastic families, but they were not nearly as dominant as they were in Europe. Largely, not because we didn't have high returns on capital, but because we were growing so fast. We were an immigrant nation, a fast-growing nation, so they hadn't been able to establish a lock. And then, after that, we had a long period of high taxation of large estates, high taxation of capital income. But now we're on our way back. Now we're on our way back towards something that looks much more like that kind of hierarchical society.
Piketty makes the point that the very size of inherited fortunes today is so great that it practically makes them invisible. Quote, wealth is so concentrated that a large segment of society is virtually unaware of its existence.
Sure. If you have conversations with people who are not in this business, who are not economists, they have no idea what real wealth means in America. They think that having $1 million makes you wealthy. They think that, or having a salary of several hundred thousand dollars makes you wealthy. And while it's certainly true, that's a vastly privileged condition compared with most people. The sheer size of those big fortunes is so far outside our normal experience that it does become invisible. You're never going to meet these people. You're never going to have any sense of what it is that they control. And most people, I think, have no idea just how, trying to, how far the commanding heights are from you and me.
You remind us often, and you did so just the other day, that the United States has a much more unequal distribution of income than other advanced countries, and that much of this difference comes from government action, such as?
If you look at, look at European countries, just about all of them, they don't actually necessarily have higher taxes on very high incomes. That's not so much the factor. And they have higher taxes overall, which are used to pay for a lot of programs of aid. So you have universal health care, and we have sort of are stumbling our way towards something like that now. But they have a lot of income support for people with low income. They have lots of support for young parents. They have lots of, basically, a lot of redistribution, which is a dirty word in U.S. politics, but in fact is essential to having a decent society. So that to be the average American is richer than the average person in France, although that's mostly because we work longer hours. But to be in the bottom of the bottom fifth in France is a far, far better thing than to be in the bottom fifth in the United States because of these government policies. It's not that wages are especially high at the bottom in France, a little bit higher than in the United States because they have a high minimum wage, but mostly you have government programs which make an enormous difference. The level of inequality of market income, what people actually make, is not that different among advanced countries. The level of inequality of disposable income, once the government has gotten through taxing and spending, is much, much higher in the U.S. than it is in most other advanced countries, and that's because of the government.
Why is, as you said, redistribution such a noxious word in our political system?
I think mostly it's just because there's a very effective apparatus that of TV and print media and think tanks and so on who hammer against any suggestion of redistribution. It just, they've managed to convince a lot of people that it is somehow un-American. Which actually, if you look at American history, that's not at all true, but it's just been pushed very hard. As I think also in the United States, look, we have to admit it, that race is always lurking under almost everything in American life. And redistribution in the minds of a lot of people means taking money from people like me and giving it to people who don't look like me. I think that is a big difference between us and Europe.
You do know that conservatives are regularly, consistently saying that inequality doesn't matter, that if the very rich were less rich, it wouldn't really make a difference to people out there working for a living.
But of course, what Europeans do, which is to tax the rich and use it to provide benefits to people lower down the scale, that makes a big difference. That can make an enormous difference. Take a few percent of national income, take it away from that top 1% and direct it towards the bottom 20%, that's a tremendous gain in the quality of life for the bottom 20%. So just think about, actually, we have a health reform. It's not the health reform we would have wanted, but it's better than no reform. It's financed in large part with small surtaxes on high incomes. That's, if you actually ask where the money's coming from, a lot of it is coming from an additional tax on investment income, an additional tax on earned income for very high earners. That is going to give basically everybody in America the guarantee of being able to have essential basic health insurance at an affordable cost. That's a huge change in people's lives, which is being financed in large part by taking a little bit from the top. So a little bit of Robin Hoodism does a lot. You could do a lot more than that. So no one is talking about just, let's punish the rich for the sake of punishing them, but the question is, can you do redistribution in a way that makes us a better society? And the answer is yes.
Well, at the end of his book, Piketty is talking about a global tax on wealth. Do you think that's feasible?
Well, is it feasible politically? If the United States were behind it, lots of things would become possible. If the United States were to support this, then I think you could pretty much guarantee that enough Europeans would be willing to go along, and while there would be some countries that would, rogue countries that would want to serve as havens for tax evasion, that we would have a lot of leverage over them. So, really, it's not that the international global system makes this impossible. It's the U.S. political system that makes it look impossible right now, and then that can change.
But given the dysfunction of Congress, given the fact that the Supreme Court has, in effect, decided to enable corporations and the rich to consolidate their hold on our political system, do you have any hope of the kind of change that both Piketty and you would advocate?
I think you don't give up hope on these things. We have, look at the American political tradition. Look at the, one of the interesting things that Pinky says is that serious progressive taxation of high incomes and great wealth is an American invention. Mm. We invented it, and we invented it in the early 20th century, right at the peak of our Gilded Age, and somehow we found it in ourselves to turn to find political leaders, people like Teddy Roosevelt, who are willing to say, this is a bad thing. We do not want the society that is emerging here. So I think things can change. What if you ask, you know, are we going to get a wealth tax, a global wealth tax before the 2016 election? Well, no, we're not. Might we get one by the 2024 election? Possibly.
You wrote something the other day that's hard to forget. You said we live in, there's such an ugliness in America right now.
Yeah. This is one of the things that puzzles me, actually, about my own country, which is, it's one thing to have disparities of income and wealth and to have differing views about what we should be doing about it, but there is a level of harshness in our debate, mostly coming from the people who are actually doing very well. So, you know, we've had a parade of billionaires whining that about being, you know, the incredible injustice that people are actually criticizing them, and then comparing anyone who criticizes them to the Nazis. You know, it's almost a tic that they have. This is very strange, and it's kind of scary, because, you know, it's one thing if someone without a lot of power seems to be going off and into a rage for no good reason, but these are people who have a lot of influence because of the amount of money they control.
Given what you've just said, and given the fact that there's this ugliness, what do you think it's going to take? A mass uprising? Consistent demonstrations? Insurgent politics? How are we going to stem the tide that he says is taking us into oligarchy?
There's a negative and there's a positive take. Pinky seems to argue for much of the book that we only escaped from the old oligarchy for a while thanks to really disastrous events, thanks to wars and depressions, right, which disrupted the system. That's an argument you can make. On the other hand, if you read histories of the New Deal, you know that it didn't spring out of nowhere. That we had a progressive movement and a lot of proto-New Deal programs building for quite a long time. There was, in fact, a move in America. There was an increasing political, philosophical readiness to take on inequality of wealth and power long before FDR moved into the White House. And so I think there are better angels of our nature, that there is this ugliness which can be frightening, but there is also a redemptive streak in here and in other places, and that you don't give up hope on this. That given consistent argumentation, given events, and perhaps, you know, as people become more aware of what is actually going on, then there is a chance of changing things. Do we know that? No, but there's nothing in what we know now that says that you should give up hope of being able to change this even without catastrophe.
Paul Krugman, thank you very much for joining me.
So there you go. Two guys that hate our guts. I mean, you know, they do. Behind closed doors, at least. Or in public, maybe. They hate our guts. They're nowhere near what we're interested in as far as the salvation and the advancement of the white race. But hidden among the toolies there is truth about the economy and so forth. You got to remember, you probably won't, that the racial cause down through history has primarily been from the left. Yes, it has. Even in the early part of the last century, it was the populace and the Grange and all those people, mostly white, that were taking on the big corporations and the big fat cats. But do you hear anybody in the racial right talking about this stuff? There may be, but I don't know them. And so I want you to know these things, because this is class war. You know, I have right-wingers always say, Metzger, you're advocating class war. Well, what do you mean? There's been class war against the white working class, the productive class, for hundreds of years. It's been going on for hundreds of years. So it's, the working class is not immediately warring with the rich. They have to. When they do, they have to. They have to rise up and do something. And then the rich always say, that's not fair. You got a union. You got laborers here coming together to get a fair wage. You're bad whites. And the rich whites, just like the plantation owners, always worked against the white workers in the South, while Negroes had a guaranteed place to live, guaranteed food, even guaranteed some schooling. And they had their churches and everything else. They didn't have to do that for white people. The rich didn't do that for white people. They were in many cases worse off than the slave, black slave. But yet, the right wing today, the neocons, and now they've come right out in the open saying they're against white racism. They used to sort of tongue-in-cheek and closet talk about it. But now the Republicans are openly against us. And technically they always were, because they always suck up to the super rich. Well, we got to talk about, we got to use material like this against them. And we got, if we can use, work with a progressive that's saying, telling the truth, we will. If we want to talk about something that the blacks are interested in, we will. Because we're not tied to any of these people. We're only tied to our situation, as the mafia used to say, our thing. It's our thing. It's a white thing. So everything should be analyzed from that point of view. Does it help the white race? I mean, the productive part of the white race, the working class whites and so forth? Or doesn't it? And if it doesn't, they're just as much an enemy as any Jew, supposedly Jew, maybe more. The same way with the blacks. You know, these right-wing Republicans use the class issue to race, and they'll rail against black crime. A lot of times that black crime is tied to things that the white super rich do. But even with all the black crime, they don't do as much harm and damage in totality as the super rich do. Got to remember that. Yeah, there are a lot of right-wing conservative racial types. They'll get on the chat boards and say, oh, that Metzger, he's a communist. Well, I think I tend to be more socialist and populist, and I think it's the way to go along those lines, and I make no apology for it. I certainly am not going to back the super rich, whether they're plantation owners with their slaves that worked against the white working class or anybody else. So that's what I got to say today. I'll be back tomorrow on Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. Let me know what you think. Let me know what you think. Who is the biggest enemy we have? I think it's capital. We could take care of these other problems very shortly if we take care of predatory capitalism. Don't forget, people like Jack London, a very hardcore white racist, was a very hardcore socialist. Labor socialist. Remember that. And if you go up on the internet, on YouTube, you probably could find some of my programs with John Jewell, who had been a official in the IWW, International Workers of the World. And now if you ask the IWW, what do you think of white racism or white racial separatism, I'd say, oh, they're horrible, we've got to kill them all. But on the other hand, a lot of things they said about the economy and labor and so forth were very correct.
Lord knows I am peaceful when I'm left alone. I've always been an eagle, been a while since I have flown. My claws are sharp as ever, so my eagle eye, something's gonna go to ground when the eagle flies. Lately I've heard rumors that the eagle may be lame. because I've been idle don't mean that I'm paid. You've jeopardized my freedom, my natural place to rule. I can fly when I have to. When you go to bed tonight, my feathers are all ruffled now. I'm ready for a fight. Just because I took a while to fly, I don't mean I don't care. When you feel the shadow crossing, eagles in the air. When you go to bed tonight, my feathers are all ruffled now. I'm ready for a fight. Just because I took a while to fly, I don't mean I don't care. When you feel the shadow crossing, leave in the air. When you feel the shadow cross.